spoonful and to tell him how wonderful it tasted. It was all she could do to keep that one spoonful down. After using her power, a confessor needed time to recover. For some, it was days. For her, it took a couple of hours. Rest, if she could get it, was the best thing for a confessor after using her power. The little rest she had gotten was now wasted. She could get no more now and probably would get none this night either. The last thing a confessor needed while recovering her power was food. It diverted her energy to the food instead of returning her strength. She had to think of a way out of eating the bowl of stew, or it would end up on the ground, to the embarrassment of all. Thankfully, she reached the wagons before she had to take another mouthful. She asked Lieutenant Hobson to go get Chandelin and the two brothers and bring them to her. After he left, she set the bowl down on the splinter bar of the dray with the casks of ale and climbed up. She motioned Captain Ryan up on the wagon as she counted. "Get some men. Unload the top rows so we can get at them all. Right the casks on the bottom row and withdraw the plugs." As he motioned for men to help with the task, she asked, "Did Chandelin have you all make a troga?" A troga was a simple, stout piece of cord or a wire with a wooden handle on each end, and long enough so that when it was given a twist, it made a loop that was the right size to drop over a man's head. It was applied from behind, and then the handles yanked apart. If it was made of wire placed correctly at the neck joints, and the man wielding it had arms big enough, his troga could decapitate a person before the victim had a chance to make a sound. Even if it wasn't wire or his arms were not that strong, the victim still made no sound before he died. Captain Ryan reached behind his back under his coat and retrieved a wire troga, holding it up for her to see. "He gave us a little demonstration. He was gentle, but I'm still glad I wasn't the one he demonstrated on. He says he and Prindon and Tossadin will use these to take the sentries and lookouts. I don't think he believes we can sneak up on them like he can. But many of us have spent a lot of time hunting. And we're more clever." Captain Ryan leapt with a yelp. Chandelin had poked him in the ribs, having come up unseen behind him. The captain comforted his ribs and scowled at a smiling Chandelin. Prindon and his brother climbed up to help unload the barrels. "You wish something, Mother Confessor?" Chandelin asked. Kaelin held her hand out. "Give me your bandu, your 10-step poison." His brow wrinkled into a scowl, but he reached into the pouch at his waist and pulled out the bone box, leaning over to hand it to her. The brothers fished out their boxes, too, and handed them to her. "How much will I be able to poison with it? How many casks can I make poison?" Chandelin stepped around Captain Ryan, balancing atop the sides of the round barrels. "You are going to put it in this drink?" Kaelin nodded. "But then we won't have any more. We must have it with us. We may need it." "I'll leave a bit for emergencies. Everyone we kill in this way is one less to fight." "But they might discover it's poison," Captain Ryan said. "Then we won't even have them drunk." "They have dogs," Kaelin said. "That's why I want to send them food, too. They will throw the dogs some of the meat to make sure it's good. I'm hoping they will be put at ease after testing the food on the dogs and anxious enough for the ale that the idea of it being poisoned won't come into their heads." Chandelin counted the barrel silently and then straightened. "There are 36, 12 for each of our bandu." He scratched his head of black hair while he pondered. "It will not kill them unless they drink much, but it will make them sick."
"How sick? What will it do?"
"It will make them weak. They will be sick in their stomachs. Their heads will spin inside. Maybe some will die in a hand of days from the poison sickness."
Kaelin nodded. "It will be of great help."
"But this is hardly enough for all their men," Captain Ryan said. "Only some will drink this.
Some will go to the unit who plundered it, and the rest will be divided among the men of rank first, with what's left going to the soldiers. The men of rank are the ones I'm after." All the top rows were unloaded, leaving only the bottom row, which the men stood up so the plugs could be removed.
"Why are six of these barrels smaller?"
"They're rum," the captain said.
"Rum? The drink of nobility?"
Kaelin smiled. "The commanders will take the rum first." She straightened from peering into one of the open casks.
"Chandelin, will they be able to taste it? Will the taste give them warning if I put more in some?"
He dipped a finger in the cask of rum and sucked it clean.
"No, this is bitter enough. Bitter things hide the taste of bandu."
Kaylin used her knife point to divide the poison from Chandelin's box into sixths. She swished each sixth off her knife point into the round opening in one of the smaller casks, those with the rum. Chandelin watched what she was doing. That much, in the smaller barrels, will probably kill them by morning, the next day for sure. But now, you have none for the other six. Kaylin handed Chandelin back his bone box with a little of the bandu left in the corners and climbed down from the dray. Six of the casks of ale will have no poison, so that we can be sure the rum will kill those who drink it. She put a knife point laden with poison from Tosadin's box into each of the next 12. Mix all the barrels up. I don't want the rum on the bottom. The commanders might not see it and take the ale instead. Kaylin went to the last 12 and opened Prindon's box. She looked up. You don't have very much. What have you done with yours? Prindon looked as though he wished she hadn't asked that question. He gestured vaguely. When we left, I was not thinking so good. You were in a hurry, and so I forgot to see that my bandu box was full. Chandelin put his fists on his hips and glared down from atop the wagon. Prindon, how many times have I said that you would forget to take your feet? Could you walk away without them? It doesn't matter, Kaylin said. Prindon looked relieved to have her interrupt Chandelin's questioning. This will make them sick. That is all that matters. As she was putting it in the barrel, she heard men in the distance hailing her. When she had swirled the poison into the last barrel, she looked up to see two huge draft horses trotting toward her. She frowned at seeing men riding them bareback and calling out to her. The two powerful draft horses looked shaggy in their thick, dun-colored winter coats, with heavy white feathering on their legs. They wore their harnesses and neck collars, but not their breeching. Several bends of chain were looped over the inside hame of each collar. The men about all stared at the odd sight. When the horses came to a halt before her, the riders unhooked the loops of chain and dropped them to the ground. She realized then that the horses were connected by that chain, attached to the hame hooks on their collars. She had never seen such a thing. The two riders slid to the ground. Mother Confessor! Their grins made their salutes look a little silly. The both of them were gangly, with short-cropped brown hair. Neither looked as if he could be 15. Their wool coats were unbuttoned in the warming day and fit them like gunny sacks on lap dogs. They both looked about to burst with excitement. They halted before getting too close, but even their fear of her couldn't wither their breathless excitement. What are your names?
I'm Bryn Jackson, and this is Peter Chapman, Mother Confessor. We had an idea and we wanted to show you. We think it'll do the job. We're sure it will. It'll work some clever. It sure will.
Kaylin looked from one beaming face to the other. What will do what job? Bryn almost leapt with joy at being asked. He hefted the chain lying in the snow between the big horses.
This!
He lugged a wad of chain to her and held it out.
This will do it, Mother Confessor. We thought of it ourselves, Peter and me.
He dumped the heavy chain on the ground.
Show her, Peter. Move 'em apart.
Peter's head bobbed as he grinned. He sidestepped his horse until the heavy chain lifted off the snow. The sag of chain swung to and fro between the hame hooks on the collars. Kaylin and all the men with her frowned, trying to understand what the peculiar rig was for. Bryn pointed at the chain.
You said we were going to leave the wagons, and we surely didn't want to leave Daisy and Pip behind. Them's our horses, Daisy and Pip. We're drivers. We wanted to help and make good use of Daisy and Pip. So we took some of the biggest trace chains and asked Morvan, he's the blacksmith, we asked Morvan to weld a couple of them together for us.
He nodded expectantly, as if that should explain it.
Kaylin dipped her head toward him a little.
And now that he has? Bryn held his hands open in excitement.
You said we needed to take out their horses.
He couldn't help giggling.
That's what this is for. You said we're going to attack at night. Their horses will be tethered to picket lines. We gallop Daisy and Pip down the picket line, one on each side, and the chain will break their legs out from under 'em. We'll take out the whole line in one sweep.
Kaylin leaned back and folded her arms. She looked to Peter. He nodded, keen on the idea, too.
Bryn, having horses chained together like that at a gallop and dragging a chain that will be catching things, heavy things, sounds to me very dangerous.
He wilted only a little.
But it could take out their horses. We can do it. We can get them for you.
They have close to 2,000 horses. Peter wilted more. Bryn scrunched up his face as he looked at the ground for the first time. He scratched his shoulder.
2,000,
he finally whispered in disappointment. Kalin glanced to Captain Ryan. He shrugged as if to say he didn't know if it would work or not. The other men standing about rubbed their chins and shuffled their feet as they pondered the rig.
It will never do, Kalin said at last.
Bryn's shoulders slumped more. There are too many of them for you. You will need more horses set up like this. Bryn and Peter's faces came up, their eyes widening. Since you two know how to do it, I want you to get all the draft horses and their drivers together. This will be the best use of their skill. Use all the equipment off the wagons or breeching you need. We'll not be taking them anyway. Have the chains made up at once, and then I want all of you to practice the rest of the day. I want you to set up things to drag the chains through, heavy things, so the horses will be used to what they're going to do. You need to practice so each team of men and horses can work together.
Peter came forward and stood next to a beaming Bryn. We will, Mother Confessor, you'll see. We can do it. You can count on us.
She gave them each a sobering look. What you want to do is dangerous, but if you can do it, it will be a great benefit to us. It could save many of our lives. Their cavalry is deadly. Take your gear and your practice seriously. Men will be trying to kill you when you do it for real. They put their fists to their hearts, this time holding their chins up.
We'll see to it, Mother Confessor. You can count on the drivers. We won't let you down. We'll get their horses.
After receiving her nod, they turned to their horses. Heads together, whispering in excitement, they went to their task. Kalin watched a lone rider in the distance, galloping through the camp. He stopped to ask a group of men something. They pointed in her direction.
They've only been with us a couple of months, Captain Ryan said. They're just boys.
Kalin raised an eyebrow to him. They are men, fighting for the Midlands. When I first saw you, I thought of you in much the same way you see them. Now I think you look a little older to me. He sighed.
I guess you're right. If they really can do the job, it will be a brilliant achievement.
The galloping rider approached and leapt from his horse before it came fully to a stop. He gave a perfunctory salute.
Mother Confessor, he gulped some air. I'm Cynric, with the sentries.
What is it, Cynric?
You said you wanted to know about everything, so I thought I'd better report. We were just setting up the sentries about an hour out, between here and the Army of the Order, near a road that crosses Jara Pass, and a coach came up the crossroad from the direction of Kelton. We knew you didn't want anything unusual going on, so we stopped the coach. I thought I'd better find out what you wanted us to do.
Who's in the coach?
An old couple, wealthy merchants of some sort, or so they claim. Something about orchards?
What did you tell them? You didn't tell them about us, did you? You didn't tell them that we have an army out here, did you?
He shook his head vehemently. No, Mother Confessor. We told them that there were outlaws in the neighborhood, and that we were a small patrol out looking for them. We told them they weren't allowed to pass until I checked with my commander. I said they had to wait until I returned.
Kalin nodded. That was quick thinking, Cynric.
The driver's name is Ahern. He wanted to argue with us and thought to give his team reins until we showed him some steel. Then the old man came flying out of the coach accusing us of trying to rob him. He started to swing his cane around at us like he thought that would drive us off or something. Anyway, we drew arrows on him and he decided he would get back in the coach.
What was his name? Cynric shifted his weight to the other foot and scratched his eyebrow.
Robin or Reuben or something like that. Feisty old fellow. Reuben, I think. Reuben Ribnick. I think that's it.
Kalin sighed as she shook her head. They don't sound like spies, but if the Order catches them, and they know anything, they will tell it all before the Daharans are through with them. She looked up.
What are they doing out here?
The old man says his wife is sick, and they're taking her to healers in Nicobarisi. She didn't look well to me. Her eyes looked to be all rolled back in her head.
Well, since they're on the road going northwest, going across Jara Pass, that shouldn't take them anywhere near the Order.
She pulled some of her long hair back off her face. But before I dare let them go, I'd best go speak to them.
Before she could take three steps, Sergeant Frost came running up behind. Mother Confessor, the tubs of whitewash are ready. The tents are heated.
Kalin let out a noisy breath. She looked from Sergeant Frost to Sentry Cynric, to other men waiting patiently to talk with her or ask instructions. She let out another breath.
Look, Cynric, I don't have the hour to ride out there and another to ride back. I'm sorry, but I just don't have the time.
He nodded. Yes, Mother Confessor, I understand. What do you wish done? She steeled herself to the orders. Kill them.
Mother Confessor? Kill them. We can't be sure of the truth of who they are, and this is too important to worry about strangers running around loose. We can't take the risk. Make it quick, so they don't suffer.
She turned away toward Sergeant Frost.
But Mother Confessor?
She looked over her shoulder.
Cynric gathered up a length of reins. The driver, Ahern, he has a royal pass.
Kaelin turned back and frowned.
A what?
A royal pass medallion. It's a medallion that was given to him by Queen Cirilla herself. It says he was a hero to the people of Ebenicia in the siege, and in honor of his service, he is to be given unhindered pass anywhere in Galia.
The queen herself gave this pass?
Cynric nodded.
I'll do what you command, Mother Confessor, but with this medallion the queen has promised him her protection.
Kaelin rubbed her forehead with her fingertips. She was so tired she could hardly focus her mind to think.
Since he has a pass given by the queen, we must honor it.
She pointed a finger to the sentry. But you tell him that he must be clear of the area immediately. Repeat what you told him about there being outlaws in the neighborhood. Tell him that you're hunting those outlaws, and that if you catch Ahern and his coach around here again, you're ordered to assume they are in with the outlaws, and you're to execute them on the spot. The road to Nicobarisi goes northeast. Tell them to keep to it and not to stop before they're a good distance from here.
Cynric clapped a fist to his heart as she turned to take Captain Ryan's arm and lead him toward the tents with the whitewash.
Behind, she heard the sentry gallop off toward the coach he had found. The other men took the hint that they weren't to come and went about other business. She loosened the thong holding her mantle closed. The temperature had climbed above freezing and the clouds had lowered nearly to the ground. The air felt wringing wet.
Fog will move in by this afternoon, he observed.
This whole valley pass will be thick with it tonight.
He glanced to her questioning frown.
I've lived in these mountains my whole life. When it takes a thaw like this in winter, the fog settles into the passes for at least a couple of days.
Kaelin surveyed the mountainsides ascending into the gray clouds.
That will serve us well, especially for what I have in mind. It will be an aid to us in bringing terror to the enemy.
So are you ready to tell me what we're to paint?
Kaelin let out a tired sigh.
We've devised a number of plans to strike targets that must be destroyed. Tonight will be our best chance of accomplishing those things, because they will be surprised. We will not have a chance of surprise like this again. After tonight, they will be expecting our next attacks.
I understand. The men, too, know the importance of this. They will do well.
We must also not lose sight of our intent. Our intent is to kill these men. Tonight, we will have the chance to do that, as perhaps at no other time. We must take that opportunity.
How many swordsmen do we have?
He was silent a moment as he tallied the numbers in his head.
Nearly 2,000 are swordsmen, not quite another 800 archers, and the rest divided up among pikemen, lancers, and cavalry, among others, including the rest of what an army needs, from drivers to fletchers to blacksmiths.
Kaelin nodded to herself.
I want you to select about 1,000 swordsmen. Pick the strongest, the fiercest, the most eager for the fight.
And what are we going to do with these men?
The men dressed up in the uniforms of the sentries we kill will make an exploration of the enemy camp and come back and give us the locations of our objectives. We have enough men to do the tasks we have assigned for those objectives. The swordsmen are for beginning our prime objective, killing the enemy. They will first see to the enemy commanders just in case they weren't poisoned, and then after that, they will kill as many men as they can in the shortest possible time.
They came to the dozen tents set up close together in a half circle.
Kaelin checked inside all to be sure they were equipped as she had ordered.
Finished checking, she stood outside the largest and faced Captain Ryan.
So are you going to tell me now what it is we're to paint?
Kaelin nodded.
Those 1,000 swordsmen.
He stared, dumbfounded.
We're going to paint the men?
Why?
It's simple. Daharans fear spirits. They fear the spirits of the foes they kill. That's why they drag the bodies of their fallen comrades away from a battle site like Ebenicia. Tonight their fears are going to come to haunt them. They are going to be attacked by the thing they fear most, spirits.
But they will recognize us as soldiers simply with white clothes, not as spirits.
Kaelin looked at Captain Ryan from under her eyebrows.
They will not be wearing clothes. They will have nothing but their swords painted white just as are they. They will remove their clothes just before the attack.
His mouth dropped open.
What?
I want you to get the swordsmen together now and assemble them here.
They're to go into the tents, remove their clothes, and dip themselves in the whitewash. After dunking themselves, they will stand near the hot rocks until dry. It won't take long. Then they can put their clothes back on until the attack. Captain Ryan stood in shock.
But it's winter. They'll freeze without clothes.
We have a break in the bitter cold. Besides, the cold will remind them to rush in and rush back out. I don't want them to stay in that camp very long. The enemy will recover from their shock in short order and set upon any invader. I want our men to attack, kill terrified Daharans, and escape. As I said, Daharans fear spirits. When they see what they think at first is their worst fear, they will be stunned. Their first thought will be to run, not to fight. Men die as easily from a sword through the back as through the front. Some will freeze in place, not knowing what to do. Even those who recognize the invaders as men painted white and not as spirits will be confused for a moment. Those few seconds of confusion, as we come upon each new group, are the seconds we need to run them through. In battle, the difference between killing and being killed is often a single moment of indecision. The swordsmen are not to engage in fights. If challenged, they're to run on to others. There are more than enough to kill. It's a mistake to waste time engaging in battle, if it can be avoided. I simply want enemy soldiers killed. After the commanders are dead, it doesn't matter which ones. I don't want our men fighting unless forced to. That only risks their lives needlessly. Rush in, kill as many men as possible, and rush out. Those are to be the orders. Captain Ryan frowned as he considered. I never thought I would hear myself say it, but I think it sounds like it might be an outlandishly successful tactic. The men aren't going to like it at first, but they'll follow orders. I'll explain it to them, and then I know they'll feel a little better about it. I've never heard of such a thing, and I'm sure the enemy hasn't either. He at last smiled a sly smile. It's sure to surprise them, no doubt about that. Kalin was relieved he had come around to that much of it. Good. I'm pleased to have the enthusiasm of a captain in the Galleon Army, in the Midlands Army. Now, I want you to have my horse's saddle and tack brought up here, and dipped in the whitewash, and please post some guards outside this tent while I'm inside. His eyes widened.
Your saddle? You're not... Mother Confessor, you can't be serious.
I would not ask my men to do something I myself would not do. They need to have a commander to rally around in their first battle. I intend to lead them. Captain Ryan took a step back. He was aghast. He regained the step.
But Mother Confessor, you're a woman, and not in any way an ugly woman.
Seemingly involuntarily, he took a quick glance the length of her.
In fact, you are... Mother Confessor, forgive me.
He fell silent. They are soldiers with a mission. Make your point, Captain. His face filled with blood.
These are young men, Mother Confessor. They are... Well, you can't expect... They are young men.
His jaw moved as he tried to find the words.
They won't be able to help themselves, Mother Confessor. Please, you'll be embarrassed beyond all tolerance.
He winced, hoping he wouldn't have to explain further. She gave him a small smile to try to ease his horror. Captain, have you ever heard the legend of the Shahari? He shook his head. When the tribes and lands now called Dahara were being forged together, the method of conquest and joining were much the same as it is with the Imperial Order. Join with them or be conquered. The Shahari people refused to join into Dahara, and they refused to be conquered. They fought so fiercely that they came to be greatly feared by the Daharan troops, who outnumbered them many times over. The Shahari loved nothing more than fighting. They were so fearless and aroused about going into war that they went into battle naked and, well, aroused. Kalin looked up to see Captain Ryan staring, mouth agape. She went on. The Daharans all know the legend of the Shahari. They all, to this day, fear the Shahari. She cleared her throat. If the men go into battle and that happens, it will only bring greater fear to the men of the Order. I don't think, though, that the men need fear being embarrassed. They will have more pressing matters on their minds, like not being killed. And if it does happen, well then, they should know it pleases me, because it will only strike greater fear into the hearts of our enemy. Captain Ryan finally looked to the ground and pushed snow with his boot.
Forgive me, Mother Confessor, but I still don't like it. It puts you at danger for nothing of much gain.
That's not true. There are two more important reasons I must do this. First,
When I left the order's camp last night, I was being chased by about 50 men. The Daharans have no doubt that those 50 men will catch me and kill me. The captain stiffened.
You mean there are 50 men roaming around here looking for you?
No, they're all dead, to a man. But the men back at camp don't know that. When they see me all white like a spirit, they will think I was killed, as I should have been, and that it's my spirit in their midst. It will only frighten them further.
All 50?
He peered up at her.
And what's the second reason?
Kaelin stared at him for a moment. Her voice came softly. When those men of the Order see me, whether they think me a spirit or think me a naked woman on a horse before them, they will stare. While they are staring, they cannot kill our men. But we can kill them. It will divert their attention from the men to me.
He gazed silently at her as she went on.
I would suffer any embarrassment on my part, she said. If it will save the life of even one of our men, I must do this to help them, and to keep them alive. He looked to the ground as he put his hands in his pockets.
I never knew the Mother Confessor was a person who cared this much for her people, he whispered. I never knew before that she cared at all what happened to any of us.
He looked up at last. Is there anything at all I can say to talk you out of doing this? Kaelin smiled. There's only one man in the world who could keep me from doing this, and you are not he. She laughed quietly. In fact, if he knew what I was about to do, I'm sure he would forbid it.
His curiosity overcame his caution.
One man? Is he your mate? She shook her head. He is the one you will choose as your mate? Kaelin sighed pleasantly. No. He is the one I'm to wed. At least I hope to wed him. He asked me to marry him.
She smiled at the confused look on his face. His name is Richard. He is the Seeker.
Captain Ryan stiffened and his breath cut off.
If I'm asking what I shouldn't, just say so, but I thought all confessors use their power. I thought your magic would... I didn't think confessors could... marry.
They can't, but Richard is special. He has the gift and my power cannot harm him. Captain Ryan smiled at last.
I'm glad... I'm happy for you, Mother Confessor.
Kaelin lifted an eyebrow. But if you ever meet him, don't you dare tell him about this, pretending to be a spirit business. He has rather fusty views about such things. If you told him you let me run around naked with 1,000 of your men, he would probably take your head off.
Kaelin laughed at the alarmed look on the captain's face.
Captain, I need a sword.
A sword? Now you're going to fight too?
Kaelin leaned toward him. Captain, if I'm sitting there naked and a Daharan wishes to despoil my honor, how am I to defend myself unless I have a sword?
Oh, well, I see your point.
He thought a moment. An idea brightened his face, and he withdrew his own sword from its scabbard. He held the weapon out in both hands. It was an old sword, with a blade pattern in the old fashion, and acid etched in the fuller to display the wavy folds of steel. This blade was given to me by Prince Harald. When I became an officer, he said it was his father's, that it was one that belonged to King Wyborn himself. He said King Wyborn held it once in battle.
He shrugged self-consciously. Of course, a king has many swords and holds many of them in battle at least once, so they will be said to have been wielded by a king in defense of his kingdom. So it's not really valuable or anything.
He looked up expectantly. But I would be honored if you took it as yours. It seems only right that, well... Since you're King Wyborn's daughter, I guess you should wield his sword in battle. Maybe it has magic or something, and will help protect your life.
Kaelin carefully lifted the sword from his hands.
Thank you, Bradley. This means a lot to me. You are wrong. It is valuable. I will carry it with honor. But I will not keep it. When I'm finished and leave for Adendril in a couple of days, then I will return it, and you will have a sword wielded not only by a king, but by the Mother Confessor, too.
He grinned with the idea of that.
Now would you please post a guard outside this tent, and then see to the swordsman?
He smiled a little smile, and brought his fist to his heart.
Of course, Mother Confessor.
As Kaelin went inside the warm tent, he was already returning with 3 men. He had a scowl on his face, as serious as any scowl she had ever seen on any officer's face.
And while the Mother Confessor is in her bath, you will keep your back to the tent, and not let anyone near. Is that clear?
Yes, Captain,
the 3 wide-eyed soldiers said together.
Inside, in the warmth, Kaylin leaned the sword against the tub, slipped off the fur mantle, and then her clothes. She was so tired she felt sick. Her stomach felt as if it were rising and falling in waves. Her head spun so that she had to fight nausea that swelled in bouts. She dragged her hand through the whitewash. It was hot, like a wonderful bath. But this was no bath. She lifted her legs over the edge one at a time and eased herself down into the silky, smooth white water. Her breasts felt buoyant in the milky pool. For a few minutes, she draped her arms over the sides of the tub, closed her eyes, and pretended it was a hot bath. She wished so much that it could be a hot bath. But it wasn't. It was something she did to keep some men alive and to kill others. She would wear white, as the Mother Confessor always did, but it would not be her dress, as always before. Kaylin lifted her father's sword and held the hilt between her breasts, with the length of the blade running down her body against her belly and between her legs. She crossed her ankles and kept her legs apart so as not to slice her thighs on the weapon. She held her nose closed with her other hand, squeezed her eyes shut tight, took a deep breath, and then submerged herself. Chapter 42. Richard and Sister Verna continued on, through a dark and humid, dank and stifling tunnel of green, ascending the gently sloping road toward the humming, haunting sound of distant flutes. Branches holding not only their own leaves, but vines of every sort spiraling around and over them, and pale moss hanging in wispy curtains, filled the gaps between trunks to the sides and nearly closed off the light from above. Short walls to each side, looking to have been built in an attempt to hold back the tangled growth, were instead being snared by it and slowly enfolded into the creeping, leafy mat of life they sought to retain. From joints in the stone block, vines sprouted, surrounding and smothering whole sections of wall, bulging it in other places, pushing the occasional stone out to hang at a drunken angle, unable to fall to the ground because of the net of tendrils. The walls looked as if they were prey, being swallowed by a ponderous predator. Only one part of the walls was untouched by the forest life, the human skulls. Atop the walls to each side, they were spaced at intervals of no more than 3 feet, each sitting on its own square of lichen-splotched stone, each clean of growth, looking like so many finials with eye sockets and toothy grins. Richard had lost count of the number of skulls. His curiosity, his dread, failed to overcome his stubborn silence. He and the sister had not spoken since their last argument. He had not even slept in camp with her, preferring instead to spend his watch and the rest of the night hunting and sleeping with Gratch. Sister Verna's angry silence was, at last, no match for his. He had no intention, this time, of being the one to make amends. They both contented themselves with looking at anything but each other. Opening into sunlight, the road widened, splitting in the distance around a striated pyramid. Richard frowned, trying to see what made it look the way it did, a dotted, pale tan with darker bands at evenly spaced intervals up its sides. He judged its height at 3 times his eye level from where he sat atop Bonnie. As they approached, he realized the mound was constructed entirely of bones, human bones. The dotted tan parts were skulls, and the bands were leg and arm bones placed end out in layers. He guessed there must have been tens of thousands of skulls in the orderly heap. He stared as they rode past. Sister Verna didn't seem to take notice. Beyond the bone pile, the wide road led into a plaza of a dark and hazy city in the middle of the thick forest. The flat hilltop had been cleared of every tree, as had the terraced fields they had passed not an hour before. The fields looked to be in preparation for planting. The ground was freshly turned, and there were stick people to scare away the birds when the seed was planted. It was winter, yet here, in this place, people planted. Richard thought it a wonder. Rather than feeling open, this vast city, cleared of every bit of green that surrounded it, seemed even more closed and dark than the tunneled road. Buildings were square with flat roofs and faced with dingy plaster the color of bark. Near the roofs and at each floor level, the ends of support logs stuck from the plastered walls. Windows were small, with never more than one in a wall. The buildings varied in height, but most were attached into irregular blocks. The tallest must have had 4 floors. None had the slightest variation in style other than their height. Haze and wood smoke obscured the sky and the buildings in the distance. The plaza seemed simply an open place around a well in the center, and was the only open area of any size. It quickly terminated in narrow, dark streets with smooth walls rising up to each side, creating man-made chasms. Overhead, many of the blocky buildings bridged the streets, making them dark tunnels, and where there were none of the bridging buildings overhead, Wash hung on lines between opposing windows. Some streets were cobblestone, but most were mud, running with fetid water. People in drab, loose-fitting clothes filled the narrow streets, walked barefoot through the mud, stood with their arms folded, watching, or sat in groups in doorways. Women carrying clay water jugs on their heads, balanced with the aid of a single hand, moved tight against the walls to make room for the 3 horses. They made their way to and from the well in indifferent silence as Richard and Sister Verna passed. A few older men sat in wide doorways or leaned against walls. The men wore brimless, straight-sided, round, dark, flat-topped hats with strange markings and light colors that looked to have been painted on with fingers. Many of the men smoked thin-stemmed pipes. Conversation fell silent as Richard and Sister Verna passed, and all watched the 2 strangers and 3 horses moving by. Some idly tugged on the long dangling earrings they wore in their left ears. Sister Verna led the way through the narrow streets, taking them deeper into the maze of drab buildings. When they at last reached a wider cobblestone street, she halted, turned to him, and spoke in quiet warning. "These people are the Majendai. Their land is a vast crescent-shaped swath of forests. We must travel the length of their land all the way to the point of the horn of their land. They worship spirits. Those skulls we saw back there were sacrifices to their spirits. Though they hold foolish beliefs which are reprehensible, we do not have the power to change them. We need to pass through their land. You will do as they ask, or our skulls will end up with all the others on that pile." Richard refused to give her the satisfaction of an answer or an argument. He sat with his hands folded over the pommel of his saddle and without emotion watched her until she finally turned away and started out once more. After passing under a low bridge building, they entered a slightly dished open square. Perhaps 1,000 men milled about or clustered in small groups. Like the other men he had seen, these all wore the 1 long dangling earring, though on the right side, instead of the left. They also all wore short swords and black sashes. Unlike the other men, none of these wore hats on their shaved heads. Off in the center, a raised platform held a circle of men sitting cross-legged, facing inward around a thick pole. Here was the source of the eerie melody. A circle of women in black sat in a ring facing outward around the men. Standing with her back against the pole, a big woman in a billowing black outfit slid the back of her hand up the pole and took hold of a knot in the end of a rope hanging from a bell. As she watched Richard and the sister ride into the square, she rang the bell once. The sister brought them to an abrupt halt as the piercing peal drifted across the square, hushing the men and urging the flute players into faster strains. "That is a warning," Sister Verna said, "a warning to the spirits of their enemies. The bell is also a call to the warriors present. Those are these men here in the square. The spirits have been warned and the warriors called. If she rings that bell again, we die." Sister Verna glanced to his even expression. "This is a sacrifice ritual to appease spirits." She watched men come and take hold of the reins of their horses. The circle of women in black stood and began to dance and twirl to the haunting music. When Sister Verna glanced at him again, Richard, with deliberate care, checked that his sword was loose in its scabbard. She sighed and then dismounted. When she cleared her throat in annoyance, he finally dismounted too. Sister Verna drew her light cloak tight around herself as she spoke to him, while watching the women in black dance and spin around the pole, and the woman in the center. "The Majendai live in a crescent around a land of swampy forest in which live their enemy. The people who live in the heart of that forbidding land are a wild, savage lot and will not allow any of us through their land, much less guide us. Even if we could avoid them, we would become lost within an hour and never find our way out. The only way for us to reach the palace of the prophets
which lies beyond these savages, is to go around them, along the crescent of land belonging to the Majendai. Our destination lies between the cusps of the crescent belonging to the Majendai and beyond the savages in the center. She glanced over to make sure he was at least listening before she went on. The Majendai are at constant war with the savages who live in that swampy forest. In order to be permitted through Majendai land, we must prove we are allied with them and their spirits and not the enemy. Those skulls we saw are the skulls of this enemy who were sacrificed to the Majendai spirits. In order for us to be permitted to pass, we must help them in this sacrifice. The Majendai believe that men with the gift, like all men, carry the seed of life and soul endowed by the spirits. More, they believe that one with the gift has a special direct link with the spirits. A sacrifice made with the aid of a young man with the gift confers the sanctifying grace of their spirits upon all their people. They believe it breathes life, divine life, on their people. The Majendai require this participation when we bring young boys through for the first time, believing it links their spirits to those of the Majendai. This ceremony also ensures that the people with whom they are at war will hate wizards because they help the Majendai and will never cooperate with them. This, the Majendai believe, denies their enemy a divine channel to the spirit world. The men in the square all drew their short swords. Laying the swords on the ground with their points toward the woman in the center, they knelt with shiny heads bowed. The woman who rang the bell, the one in the center, is the leader of these people, the Queen Mother. She is the one who is bound to the female spirits. She represents the spirits of fertility in this world. She is the embodiment of the receptacle of the divine seed from the spirit world. The dancing women in black formed into a line and started off the platform in the direction of Richard and the sister. The Queen Mother is sending her representatives to take you to the sacrificial offering. Sister Verna glanced up at him, then fussed with the corner of her cloak. We are fortunate. This means they have one to be sacrificed. If we came here and they didn't, we would have to wait until one of their enemy was captured. Sometimes that can take weeks, even months. Richard said nothing. She turned her back to the approaching women in black and faced him. You will be taken to a place where the prisoner is held. There you will be offered the chance to give your blessing. Not giving your blessing means you wish to precede the prisoner in sacrifice. If you don't give your blessing, it will only ensure that you die too. You give your blessing by kissing the sacred knife they will offer you. You don't have to kill the person with your own hand. You have only to kiss the knife to give your blessing, to give the spirits blessings, and they will do the killing. But you must watch them do it, so the spirits will see the sacrifice through your eyes. She glanced over her shoulder at the approaching women in black. The beliefs of these people are obscene. She sighed in resignation and turned to face him again. Richard folded his arms and glared at her. I know you don't like this, Richard, but it has kept peace for 3,000 years between us and the Majendai. Though it sounds a paradox, it saves lives, more lives than it costs. The savages who are their enemy make war not only on them, but also on us. The palace and the civilized people of the old world are sporadically subjected to their raids and fierce attacks. Small wonder, Richard thought, but said nothing. Sister Verna stepped aside to stand at his shoulder as the women in black formed into a dark knot before the two of them. All were older, perhaps the age of grandmothers. They were all portly, and their black outfits covered their hair and everything else except their wrinkled hands and faces. With gnarled fingers, one drew the coarse black fabric tight at her chin. She bowed her head to Sister Verna.
Welcome, wise woman. Our sentries have told us of your approach for nearly a day now. We are pleased to have you among us, for it is the time of the planting sacrifice. Though we had not expected your presence, it will be a great homage to the spirits to have the blessing in their sacrifice.
The old woman, who only came up to the height of his breastbone, looked Richard up and down. Then she spoke again to Sister Verna.
This is a magic man. He is not a boy.
We have never before brought one so old to the palace of the wise women, Sister Verna said. But he is a magic man the same as the others. The old woman in black looked into Richard's eyes as he watched her without expression.
He is too old to give the blessing.
Sister Verna tensed.
He is still a magic man.
The woman nodded to the sister.
But he is too old to have others perform the sacrifice for him. He must do it himself. He must give our sacrifice to the spirits by his own hand."
She gestured for a woman behind to come forward. "Lead him to where the offering awaits." With a bob of her head, the woman came forward and indicated he was to follow. Sister Verna tugged on his shirt sleeve. Richard could feel the heat of magic radiating from her fingers, up his arms, terminating in an uncomfortable tinkling sensation at his neck under the Radahan.
"Richard," she whispered, "don't you dare swing the axe this time. You know not what you will bring to ruin."
Richard met her eyes before turning away without a word. The round old woman led him off down a muddy street, past old men sitting in doorways watching, and then turned them down a narrow alley. At the end, she stooped through a low doorway. Richard had to bend nearly in half to follow. Inside, carpets of intricate designs but dull colors covered the floor. There was no furniture except several low leather-covered chests holding oil lamps. Four men with shaved heads squatted rather than sat on the rugs, two to each side of a passageway hung with a heavy tapestry instead of a door. Short spears with sharp, leaf-shaped iron heads rested across their knees. The unexpectedly high ceiling held a cloud of pipe smoke. The men stood and bowed to the old woman. She bobbed her head to them and, as she did so, drew Richard forward.
"This is the magic man. Since he is the age of a man, the Queen Mother directs that the spirits take the sacrifice through his hands."
They all nodded and gave grim agreement that it was a wise decision, and prayed she would tell the Queen Mother that it would be done as directed. The woman in black bid them fair fortune in the task. She closed the rough spruce door behind herself after stooping through the low opening. When she was gone, the men broke into grins. They all slapped Richard on the back as if taking him into their confidence. The back of one man's shaved neck wrinkled in rows of furrows as he turned to glance at the tapestry-covered passageway. He put an arm around Richard's shoulder, giving it a squeeze with powerful fingers.
"You are fortunate indeed, lad. You'll like what we have for you."
His sly smile revealed a missing bottom tooth.
"Come with us. You'll like this, lad. We can promise you, you will."
He gave a hearty chuckle.
"Today, you'll be a man, if you're not one yet."
The other three laughed with him. The three pushed the tapestry aside, taking one of the lamps with them. The last man patted Richard's back, ushering him through. They all chuckled with anticipation. The next room was much the same as the first, minus the pipe smoke. They led on through a sequence of rooms, each bare of decoration except for a few carpets scattered about. The men finally squatted beside a last covered passageway, planted the butts of their spears, and with a hand on them for support leaned toward him. They all shared the same cunning smiles.
"Careful now, lad. Don't be too anxious. Keep your head about yourself, and you'll have yourself a time with this savage."
They chuckled again with a private joke as they pushed the hanging aside and went through. Inside, the small square room had a bare dirt floor. The ceiling was at least three stories high. A window near the top of one wall cast the small room in dim light. The place smelled of the chamber pot off to the side. Crouched to the far wall was a naked woman. She tried to push herself farther into the corner when she saw the men. Arms around her knees, she pulled them tight to herself. She was covered with dirty marks and smears, cuts and bruises. Her mass of long, tangled black hair frizzed out, framing her filthy face. Her dark eyes narrowed with loathing as she watched the four men. By their leering smiles, she had cause to know them. Around her neck was a thick iron collar connected by heavy chain to a massive pin in the wall. The men spread out around the room, squatted, and leaned their backs against the walls. Their fists held their spears upright between their knees. Richard imitated them, squatting and leaning against the wall to the woman's right.
"I wish to speak with the spirits," Richard said.
The four men blinked at him. "I must ask them how they wish it done."
"There is only one way to do it," the man with the missing tooth said. "You must cut off her head. Now that the iron collar is around her neck, it's the only way to get her out. Her head must be separated from her body."
"Even so, it must be done in the manner the spirits wish. I must talk with them. I must know exactly how to do this, to please them."
They all considered this. The man with the missing tooth,
pushed his cheek out with his tongue as he pondered. Finally, he brightened.
The Queen Mother and her women drink juka to speak with the spirits. I could bring you some juka, and then you too could speak with the spirits.
Then bring me this juka, so I may speak with the spirits and do as they command. I would not want to make a mistake and ruin your planting sacrifice. The men agreed that this was a wise request, considering that Richard was to make the sacrifice himself instead of simply blessing it. One of the men hurried off. The other three waited in silence, again leering at the woman. She moved her feet closer together to cover herself as she squatted in the corner, and glowered back. One man pulled a thin-stemmed pipe and a long splinter from a pocket. He lit the splinter in the flame of the lamp and used it to light his pipe. He puffed as he watched the woman, eyeing her in an intimate way. Her chin held defiantly up. The woman glared back. The smoke drifted up into the dim air as his steady puffing quickened. Richard crouched, leaning against the wall with his arms folded across his lap, so as to partially hide his right hand, draped nonchalantly near the hilt of his sword. The fourth man finally came back, carrying a round clay pot in both hands. The pot had a small opening in the top and white symbols painted around the sides.
The Queen Mother and her women agreed and sent you this juka, so you may call the spirits. When you drink this, the spirits will visit you.
He set the pot in front of Richard and then, pulling a knife from his belt, held the green malachite handle out to him. It was carved with figures in obscene poses.
This is the sacred knife to be used in the sacrifice.
When Richard took the knife and slid the stout blade behind his belt, the man joined with his fellows squatting against the walls. The man closest to the woman on the other side seemed pleased that the Queen Mother had sent the juka. He gave Richard a knowing wink. Then he lifted his spear point to the woman's face.
The magic man has come to offer you to the spirits.
He smiled encouragement past her to Richard.
But first, he would like to give you the spirit's gift of his seed.
She didn't move. His smile transformed into a sneer as he thumped the butt of his spear to the dirt.
Do not insult the spirits. You will take their offering.
His voice lowered to a growl.
No.
Her eyes never leaving him, she uncoiled herself and obediently lay down on the dirt on her back. She opened her legs and cast Richard a defiant glance. She obviously knew the consequence of denying these men what they wished. The man sprang forward and stabbed his spear into her thigh muscle. She screamed out and flinched back.
You know better than that. You will not insult us. We are not stupid.
He feigned another jab.
Do it properly.
Richard's fingers curled around the hilt of his sword, but otherwise he did not move. The woman made no effort to tend the bleeding gash on her leg, but instead obediently turned over onto her elbows and knees, sticking her bottom up in the air. The men chuckled to Richard.
You would not like to lie with this one face to face,
the man with the missing tooth said.
She bites.
The others nodded their certain knowledge of that.
Mount her this way and hold her by the hair. She will not be able to bite you this way, and you can have all you wish.
The men waited. Neither Richard nor the woman moved.
Can you fools not see? The woman said. He does not wish to mount me like a dog in front of you.
Her face lying against the dirt, she gave Richard a mocking smile.
He is shy. He does not wish you to see how little his magic stick is.
Every eye was on him. Richard's knuckles were white around the hilt. He strained to put an emotionless face over the rage of the magic searing through him from the sword. He struggled to maintain reason. Letting the magic loose in here would accomplish nothing. One of the men gave a playful elbow to another and laughed.
Perhaps she is right. He is a young one. Maybe he is not used to others watching his pleasure.
The seams around his control were strained near to bursting. Richard concentrated on keeping his free hand steady and making it move gracefully. He lifted the clay pot with the juka, showing it to them. He labored mightily to keep his voice even. The spirits wish to speak to me of important matters. The smiles all withered. They knew him as a magic man, but not a young one, as they were used to seeing. They didn't have any idea of his power, but were obviously worried about it. Worry about his smoldering, too quiet smoothness.
We must leave him to his duty, one of the men said. We should leave him to be with the spirits and to take his pleasure from the savage, if he wishes, before he gives the spirits this offering.
He bowed his shiny head to Richard.
We will leave you to your peace. We will wait in the room where you saw us first.
Solemn-faced, the four hurried off. After they were gone and she could be sure they were a good distance away, the woman spat at him. She arched her back like a cat in heat, sticking her behind higher in the air. You may mount me now like the dog you are. Come, magic man. Prove you can mount a woman when she is held for you by a chain. You can do no worse to me than the other dogs. She spat at him again. You are all dogs.
Richard extended his leg and shoved a foot against her hip, tipping her over.
I'm not like those men.
She rolled onto her back. She threw her arms and legs open and gave him a contemptuous glare.
So, you wish to have me like this to prove you are better than they?
Richard gritted his teeth.
Stop it. I'm not here for that.
She sat up. She lifted her chin, but her eyes filled with sudden terror.
So, you will sacrifice me now?
Richard realized his hand was still gripping the hilt. He had forgotten to maintain a calm expression. He took his hand away, letting the magic recede and his rage cool. As she watched, he poured the juka on the dirt floor.
I'm going to get you out of this. My name is Richard. What's yours?
Her eyes narrowed.
Why do you wish to know?
Well, I'm here to take you out of here. I need to know what to call you. I can't call you woman. She surveyed him silently for a moment.
I am Duchailu.
Do I call you Du or Chailu or Duchailu? Puzzlement wrinkled her brow.
Duchailu, that is my name.
Richard gave her a smile of reassurance.
All right then, Duchailu.
Who are your people?
What are they called?
We are Baka Ban Mana.
And what does that mean, Baka Ban Mana?
Her chin came up again.
Those without masters.
Richard smiled to himself. I think you are worthy of your people. You don't look to be a woman to be mastered.
Chin still held up. She studied his eyes. You say these words, but you intend to mount me as the others.
Richard shook his head. No, I told you I wouldn't do that. I'm going to try to get you out of here and back to your people.
None of my people captured by the Majin Dai ever returns.
Richard leaned toward her. Then you shall be the first.
Richard drew his sword. Duchailu scooted back against the wall, drawing her knees up to her chest, hiding her face. He realized that she had misinterpreted his action and expected the worst.
It's all right, Duchailu. I'm not going to hurt you. I simply need to get that collar off you.
She shrank from him. Then, thinking better of her shameful retreat, she lifted her head and spat at him.
Yes, by taking off my head. You do not speak the truth. You wish to kill me now and just want me to meekly offer you my neck.
With his sleeve, Richard wiped the spittle off the side of his forehead. He reached out and put a comforting hand to her shoulder.
No, I'm not going to hurt you. I simply need to use this sword to get the collar off. How else can I get you out of here? You will be safe, you'll see. Let me get it off you.
Swords cannot cut iron.
Richard lifted an eyebrow.
Magic can.
She squeezed her eyes shut and held her breath as he gently put an arm around her shoulder and rolled her face down in his lap. He laid the sword's point to the side of her neck. He had seen the Sword of Truth cut through iron before, and he knew the sword's magic could do the job. She lay dead still as he slid the sword under the heavy iron band. And then she lunged at him. In a blink, she had a fierce grip on his left arm. Her teeth clamped around his forearm, pinching the nerves. Richard froze. He knew that if he were to try to yank his arm back, her teeth would probably tear the muscle from the bone. He still had his right hand on the sword. The rage of the magic pounded through him. He used the anger to help him block the pain and remain still. With the sword under the collar as it was, it would be a simple matter to give it a twist and a push. It would cut her throat if not decapitate her, and he would be free of her teeth. The pain from her locking bite was agonizing.
Duchailu, he managed through gritted teeth. Let go. I'm not going to hurt you. If it were my intention to hurt you, I could cut you right now with the sword and make you let go.
After a long moment, silent of everything but his labored breathing, she relaxed the pressure of her teeth, but didn't release his arm from her grip. She tilted her head up a bit.
Why?
Her eyes peered up at him.
Why do you wish to help me?
Richard stared down into her dark eyes. He took a chance and removed his hand from the sword. He brought the hand up and touched his fingers to the cold metal collar around his neck.
I, too, am a prisoner. I, too, know what it is to be held by a collar. I don't like collars.
Though I can't free myself in this way, I can try to free you. Her ferocious grip on his arm relaxed. She cocked her head to the side as she frowned up at him.
But you are a magic man.
That's why I was taken prisoner. The woman I'm with is taking me to a place called the Palace of the Prophets. She says the magic will kill me if I don't go to this place.
You are with one of the witches? From the Big Stone Witch House?
She is not a witch, but one with magic too. She put this collar on me to make me go with her. Duchilu's eyes flicked over the collar around his neck.
If you let me go, the Majendai will not allow you to go through their land to the Big Stone House.
Richard gave her a little smile. I was hoping that if I helped you get back to your people, you would permit us to pass through your land and maybe that you would guide us so that we might reach the palace. A sly smile spread on her lips.
We could kill the witch.
Richard shook his head. I don't kill people unless I'm forced to. It would not help anyway. I must go to the palace to get my collar off. If I don't go there, I will die. Duchilu looked away from his gaze. Richard waited while she glanced around her prison.
I do not know if you speak the truth or if you mean to cut my throat.
She gently rubbed his arm where she had bitten him.
But if you kill me, I was to be killed anyway and had no chance. And at least I will not be mounted any more by those dogs. If you tell the truth, then I will be free. But we must still escape. We are still in the land of the Majendai.
Richard winked. I have a plan. At least we can try. She frowned at him.
You could do this thing to me, and they would be happy. And you could go to the palace. You would be safe. Are you not afraid they will kill you?
Richard nodded. But I am more afraid to live the rest of my life seeing in my mind your pretty eyes and wishing I had helped you. She gave him a sidelong glance.
Maybe you are a magic man, but you are not a smart man. A smart man would want to be safe.
I am the Seeker.
What is this, the Seeker?
It's a long story, but I guess it means I do my best to see the truth prevail, to see right done. This sword has magic, and it helps me in my quest. It's called the Sword of Truth.
She let out a long breath and finally laid her head back in his lap.
Try then, or kill me. I was dead anyway.
Richard gave her filthy bare back a pat of reassurance.
Hold still. He reached under her neck and wrapped his fingers around the collar, holding it tight. With his other hand, the hand on the hilt, the hand through which the magic was coursing into him, he gave a mighty heave. With a loud crack, the iron shattered. Hot shards of metal ricocheted off the walls. One large piece spun like a top in the dirt, finally wobbling and falling over. Silence settled over them. He held his breath, hoping none of the metal fragments had cut her throat.
Duchilu sat up.
Her eyes wide, she felt her neck. Finding no injury, she broke into a wide grin.
It is off. You got the collar off and my head is still attached.
Richard feigned a touch of indignation.
I told you I would.
Now we must get away from here. Come on. He led her back through the rooms the way he had come in. When he reached the next to last room, from where the man waited, he held a finger to his lips and told her to be quiet and wait for him to come back for her. She folded her arms under her bare breasts.
Why? I will go with you. You said you would not leave me here.
Richard let out an exasperated breath. I'm going to get you some clothes. We can't leave with you. With a gesture, he indicated her bare condition.
She unfolded her arms and looked down at herself. Why? What is wrong with me? I am not a bad shape to look upon. Many men have told me, what is it with you people?
He whispered heatedly. I have seen more naked people since I left my homeland last autumn than in the whole of my life, and not a one of you seems the least bit.
She grinned. Your face is red.
Richard growled through gritted teeth.
Wait here.
Smirking, she folded her arms again.
I will wait.
In the outer room, the four men jumped to their feet when Richard came through the carpet-covered opening. He didn't give them any time to ask questions.
Where are the woman's clothes?
Confused, they glanced at one another.
Her clothes? Why do you want?
Richard took an aggressive stride toward the men.
Who are you to question the spirits? Do as they say. Get me her clothes.
All four flinched back. They stared at him briefly and then went to the low chests. They set the lamps aside and opened the lids, rummaging through the chests, tossing clothes aside.
Here, I found them,
one of them said. He held up a garment that looked to be finely woven flax. Different colored strips hung in rows from the light brown fabric.
This is hers.
He held up a buckskin belt.
and this too.
Richard snatched them from the man's fist. You wait here. He grabbed up a scrap of cloth the men had thrown on the floor as they had searched for the dress. He went back through the opening before there was time for any questions. Duchailu waited, her arms still folded. When she saw what he held in his hands, she gasped. She clutched the dress to her breast. Tears filled her dark eyes.
My prayer dress!
She threw her arms around his neck and, raising up on her tiptoes, started kissing him all over his face. Richard mashed her mass of black hair flat against the sides of her head as he pushed her away.
All right, put it on, hurry!
Grinning at him, she pulled the dress over her head, poking her arms through the long sleeves. Up the outside of each arm and across the shoulders was a row of little strips of different colored cloth. Each was knotted on, through a small hole beneath a corded band. The dress came to just below her knees. As she tied the belt at her waist, Richard noticed the blood still running down to her foot from where the man had stabbed her in the thigh. He dropped to one knee before her and motioned with his hands. Lift it up. Lift up your dress. Duchailo looked down at him. She lifted an eyebrow. I have just covered myself, and now you wish me to uncover? Richard pursed his lips. He waved the strip of cloth at her. You are bleeding. I need to put this around the wound. Giggling, she raised her skirt and held her leg out, rotating it from side to side, displaying it in a teasing manner. Richard quickly wrapped the cloth around her thigh over the gash and jerked the knot tight. She yelped with pain. He thought it served her right, but apologized anyway. Taking her by the hand, he pulled her through the remaining rooms. As he passed through the last, he growled at the four men to stay where they were. Still holding Duchailu's hand tight, he led her back down the alleyway and streets to the open square. He saw the heads of the three horses sticking up above the sea of shiny, bald heads. He plowed his way through the throng toward the horses. Chapter 43. Although his sword sat in its scabbard, he was already drawing its magic. Rage surged into him. He summoned it, ever onward, letting his barriers fall free before its advance. He was entering a silent world all his own, a world of grim committal to what he was, bringer of death. Sister Verna paled when she saw him pulling Duchailu after, becoming even paler when she saw his demeanor. Without a word to her, Richard snatched his bow off the side of his saddle. He grunted with the effort of swiftly stretching the bowstring to the bow. He yanked two steel-bladed arrows from the quiver hanging from Bonnie's saddle. His chest heaved with wrath. The crowd had all turned toward him. Puzzled faces bobbed up as men behind jumped to get a view. The women in black all looked up in his direction. The Queen Mother watched. Sister Verna's face was by now bright red.
Richard, what do you think?
Richard shoved her back. Be quiet. Bow and arrow was in hand. He leapt up onto the saddle. The mumbling fell silent. Richard directed himself to the Queen Mother. I have spoken with the spirits. The back of the Queen